creativity, hustlers, fakers, and thieves. Creativity is not the province of just a chosen few. Those who fear they have nothing to say or that it's all been said before can also grab the fire. But our ideas about practice, quality, or failure shape our work. New artists, working artists, strugglers, those who have been at it all their lives grapple with these same concepts. This is the heart of our endeavor, finding the different and similar ways that artists work to be creative. On Creativity, Hustlers, Fakers, and Thieves. Ali, hello, greetings.
Yes, sir. Hello, Gary.
Our chat today is about inspiration. Why do artists create? They get an idea, they are inspired, we say, but by what? A scent on the breeze, a cookie, a madeleine, two birds chasing each other across the sky. What causes a creative person to say to themselves, I wonder if I could do that in wood or metal or on the canvas or in a dance? This inspiration can come from many places. Sometimes for me, working at the bench on something mundane sparks ideas, a lot of ideas. And reading always sparks ideas. Getting out of my daily routine. What helps you, Ali? What inspires you in your work?
I think a lot of it for me is just the need to be creative on some sort of level or another. Messing around in my studio or my shop with my tools and with materials, and then something will happen. Something inspires something else. I think the best analogy for it is like exercise. There's a lot of times where I don't feel like exercising, and then I just go for a run, or I start running and, you know, I'm like, oh, I'll just do a mile. But then that mile feels so good when it's over that then I run another 5 miles. It was starting to do that first mile, you know. And then I think that could happen with furniture too. Like, you know, if I spend enough time looking at things like, you know, Nakashima chairs and, you know, and Wharton, you know, Escherich and things like that, you know, and these sort of things like, you know, Maloof or whoever, and you could be shoved into a corner where like, why bother?
Well, let's talk with Sean Hogan, a garden designer. I can't help but call him a visionary when he talks about plans for the new botanical garden in Portland and things he's done around the country. So let's sit in on this conversation.
You're not going to tell me what inspires you?
Well, I said that ideas come when I'm working at the bench.
Right. It's the same thing.
But it's usually when I'm doing something mundane and not trying to be creative that ideas start occurring. I'll tell you another place where I find a strange sort of inspiration is coming out of sleep and just starting to draw, and with nothing in mind, no direction, just noodling and see where that takes me. Coming out of a dream state, there's less of that critic, that ever-present critic. He's still asleep, I guess. So I have a chance to just play around on the page and see where it takes me. And that's a lot of fun and inspiring. I'm here with Sean Hogan, garden designer, nurseryman, Cistus Design Nursery, neighbor of mine for many years, owner of Brody, the wonder dog.
Explore, breed, introduce, look for, and hopefully get out to the world new and appropriate plants for our region in northwestern Oregon, but hopefully all over the place. Running a nursery is lots of fun, mostly, but lots of moving parts and lots of things, and fun right now with a brand new website.
The website is?
Cistus.com. So brand new everything happening with lots more connectivity, which of course means homework. Content, yeah, as they say, which is lovely, but you don't want to be have your website launch with no clothes on. So we're clothing ourselves. And
although the internet was founded on different principles, I agree with you.
That is a good point. And we have not introduced that yet into our own website, though it might draw traffic or scare people away. I'm not sure which.
Yeah.
The nursery is very fun, but it's, you know, it's a few different things. It's having a factory, hopefully making a decent product, but also attempting to inspire people to think outside the boxwood, as they say in horticulture, sorry, and try new things and become excited also about.
But you've done some big projects as a garden designer, like, for instance, that little company down in California?
Right. Apple Campus, headquarters, that was quite an adventure.
What did you do there?
I developed the plant palette, then led the team in sort of designing where those plants would go with an amazing landscape architect who it was hand in glove with them. So it was very good. We got a great landscape in, and I think at least to some degree changed the face of horticulture in the Bay Area in the difficult transition between more traditional plants. We all desire the English garden somehow still, even on this side of the continent. They switched over to native, almost all Western native and some Mediterranean things. It's business, it's campuses, it's residential. I've been lucky actually to be able to pick and choose a little bit the projects I do, because there are some really interested people and interesting people out there, and they're fun to hang out with.
So when you start a project, let me just say what happens to me and compare your experience to mine. I'll sit down with a client, and in conversation with them, something will pop into my head. Does that happen to you, or do you already come in with an idea?
Oh, no, I just tell them what they want.
Exactly.
No, it's always a conversation. Like I think any design would do, it becomes a combination of the physical space we're looking at, whether it's a campus or a residence. Sometimes it faces north, sometimes it faces south. Sometimes there are the next step, have to have a giant outdoor kitchen and grill or whatever. There are necessities also. And then we get to the fun part, which is how do you want to create your surroundings? I attempt to listen because people are excited.
Do you get a blank slate sometimes?
Sometimes.
Yeah. How do you face that?
Well, blank slates are fun, but it also depends on how much input is there from said client. I love the idea of just being able to start from scratch, but there are people that say, oh, just do what you do. I just love it. Anything. And there's about a 76.3% chance that if you just do what you do without input, there'll be things they don't like about it.
I think it's a higher percentage.
Yeah. All right. But I thought you'd do X, Y, or Z. So no matter what they say, I pull the same information out of them. Sometimes it's more conversational, sometimes not. I want to know their nest before we do anything. And then it gets them excited about it. And then they always come up with more specifics.
How do I think about your method of design? Is it color? Is it texture? Is it plants? I know there are certain requirements, as you just mentioned, they need a barbecue or that they need space. Or
almost any garden, any place, any campus, any building needs what I call intuitive wayfinding. You're on a college campus, and it's where the architects have put all the pathways, and then it's where people actually walk. There are all the desire paths walking through things or the dirt through the turf. I try to predict where the dirt pathways will be, either physically or metaphorically, before they are ever an issue. Before we even start an interview, there's climate, there's exposure, there's building, there's style, there are all kinds of things that I have in mind. And then with client, we can jump ahead a little bit, listen to ideas. It's a pretty quick process to then start putting shapes into place. I don't know if that quite answered your question.
But. Well, it does and it doesn't a little. I'm really interested in wayfinding because one of my design books shows a path, just as you say, you know, in the sort of meandering path, not a straight line, the way we lay out sidewalks is this meandering byway. And divining that must be challenging.
I think it's fun. I think part of, you know, having done design for a while, there are good points to being a tiny bit jaded.
Jaded in what sense?
Jaded in that one can predict, for instance, in a given space, human cadence. Often people get so excited about any design. There are a lot of elements. And then let's put paths to those elements. Mm-hmm. And so it can be really disjunct, but even if it's not, there are paths between things. A good example is those that want a hot tub. If it's not easy enough to step right out of your whatever into the hot tub, you're just not going to use it.
Right.
It's too much work. And any spot where you're traversing in your own space, if you have to go to effort to even walk around the garden, it mentally becomes too much work. It's awfully good to have, for instance, a series of open spaces that I call negative space and elements within those. Mm-hmm. So not only does it not look too cluttered, but it's easy to do. It's just easy going.
This brings to mind Christopher Alexander's book, A Pattern Language. Are there patterns around the world that garden designers know of, people respond to?
There are. And I think it really depends on, you know, what you're trying to get out of it. We don't all have Versailles to redesign. Our world is finite, so we do all that within that world.
You know, a budget.
An AKA budget, yeah. I'm in love with pattern language. I mean, it just says so much. But there are behaviors, and we as a species seem to repeat those no matter how we try to escape that. There are just things we do and things we want to do. So part of it is, how do we create the atmosphere for ourselves? Makes ourselves content, most of all, and happy. But also, one of the bigger aspects of it is what I call the company's coming syndrome. What's it going to be like when people arrive? Uh-huh. And how we use our space, but how we imagine we use our space, often really different things. And sometimes how we never use our space, but wish we did, is more important. I think I told you about having a couple of Adirondack chairs out in the garden, what we called the moon garden at the old house. Uh-huh. And looking out the dining room one day, I could just get a glance of them. I'd had those things in the garden 12 years. It just dawned on me that every time I turned the corner and looked outside, I'm busy doing something else. I thought, oh, I could be sitting out there in the garden and all the things that could be happening. I got a glass of wine, first vodka of the morning, whatever I'm doing. I also then thought, because I had sat in those chairs twice in 12 years, both of them for interviews. So it's like, sit in here, we'll turn on the cameras and it'll look really natural. Just, you know, do what you do. It's like, yeah, but I never do this.
Yeah, one of the most unnatural things.
Relaxing in the garden, I don't think so. Part of it is the imagination. So when we're looking at physical things in somebody's garden, yes, you want to imagine what it's going to be like when company comes. And part of that intuitive wayfinding is, no matter what the building situation, you want people to feel comfortable with knowing where the front door is. More difficult sometimes than you might think. But you're going to look at your garden, most of us, more from inside doing something else than you are ever from when you're outside. There are views you imagine, and there are views that are reality. For myself, we've been tackling a 5-acre addition to the property. It was a tangle when we took it over. And I need at least the illusion that the inner neatness freak in me can be soothed. I've designed it so looking out of the house, it's a gravel terrace, it's rather simple plantings. So I can pretend that life is in order when I look out from my office.
Ah, yes. Nature conquered. I've done it again.
At least the first 10 feet for the moment.
We're on Sauvie Island outside of Portland, about 10 miles northwest of Portland, along the Willamette River. From this, you can see Mount Hood on a clear day. See St. Helens on a clear day.
Very much right out the window.
Yeah.
The giant ships in the Columbia Harbor.
Very flat island, incredibly productive, verdant. And it was a 5-acre parcel that the previous owners had.
Right.
And you started a little nursery in back with Parker.
Back in the day when things were in black and white.
Yeah. But then created this amazing garden space with plants from different zones and just a completely different way of experiencing a nursery compared to most. Here's what strikes me. Tell me if I'm way off base. It seems like you have to gather a whole lot of knowledge and information in order to help your clients.
I would expect, even if it's not the reality, that anyone doing work that is serving a client base needs to know a lot of stuff in order to help their clients. Otherwise, what's in it for the client? You know, with any question, with any decision, really, there are sometimes hundreds of moving parts, even with a garden.
Yeah, well, there's lots of cookie cutter designers out there.
Sure.
They saw in House Beautiful this month, fine gardening, and there you go.
No, exactly. And I think a combination of things. One size doesn't fit all on this very large continent we live on. Part of what we do is maybe suggest that this thing does really well in New Jersey, really isn't the best thing for here, unless you have another $500 a month for watering it. Right plant, right place is kind of a cliche, but right garden, right region is much more what we're looking at. So we're really trying to do things that really make success in the garden.
Has your palate changed over time?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I used to grow really crappy things, and now
you know how.
I like plants from all over the world. I love colors and textures and succulents and not succulents. And we used to grow probably a larger percentage of, say, Asian textural plants, meaning things like schefflerias and palms and things like that. We still do. And things that are appropriate for this climate, but also really love things that are wildly inappropriate. And then, you know, there's been a movement, of course, of very minimalist gardens, which kind of look good in a magazine, but in reality, they're kind of like scratching your fingernails on a chalkboard. They can be pretty discombobulating if you live in one. because you don't have that balance of human-made architecture with quote-unquote natural surroundings.
Right.
You've got square on square on square. And to me, that overdoes it a bit.
Have you ever gone fallow? Have you run out of ideas?
Oh, daily. Several times a day. Yeah, absolutely. No, it's funny. I will be super enthusiastic and full of ideas about a project, and it gets to a certain point, especially when there are conflicting ideas, either from client or from the situation. And at some point, if I realize I'm forcing an idea onto that piece of paper, I totally shut down. Mm-hmm. So, and sometimes, honestly, it's days before I can circle around. And honestly, I probably have 25 or 30 projects right now that I need to circle back to.
How do you get started again?
Usually at 3 a.m. or so.
Really?
I come up with an idea about that project.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah.
Are you asleep or awake or in the middle?
It's in the middle. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, my phone the next morning is filled with notes that don't mean a damn thing.
Like writing on that pad next to your...
Yeah.
It's like, exactly. Write in Arabic.
Yeah, exactly. No, I also... It's essentially... typing a text to myself without my glasses on. It's kind of the same thing. Yeah. Some of the sentences are actually pretty entertaining in the morning, but they don't necessarily mean anything.
It's interesting that mid-zone between your dream state and being fully awake and
mm-hmm.
unable to sleep. And those aren't productive times for me.
No, but often writing it down is great.
Writing it down is important.
It's what I call the idea train. Once one little problem is solved, my mind jumps all over the place. Uh-huh. Sometimes it'll solve a bunch at once. And it's often they weren't problems. I've learned enough now to realize that when I'm not feeling inspired by that portion of the project or that stage of the project, I could force it through, but I know I'm never as happy with it. So I do let it rest.
Yeah, I find I'm working at the bench and doing something that needs to be done, but it's, you know, I wouldn't say mundane, but it's sort of regular. And my mind just starts jumping to these other ideas.
Well, I think for me, having a somewhat notoriously ask my friends short attention span, it really does help for me to be able to concentrate maybe intensely on one thing and then just leave it for a little bit. But I've got another thing, a shiny object right over here.
Yeah.
I will circle back around. I know people say you can't do that, but I seem to have to.
Well, I think one of the things that's important is finding the rhythm, the pace, the flow that a creator needs and learning to nurture that. In the center of the storm, what do you think of this quote? This is from Buckminster Fuller. And it was actually from a book on mathematics that I was reading on the golden ratio. If the solution is beautiful, then I know it's right.
There are so many different types of projects. Sometimes the solution just has to be factual. But to me, the solution, it's warm and fuzzy as much as it is beautiful. Somehow I want to sit down with a glass of wine at the result of that thought process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's then that I know that this is going to be a good spot. Just getting there is a dam that breaks, and then suddenly everything else fills in.
Can you describe your design work in three words?
For me, it would be listen, imagine, and immerse. I've got to be able to put together all these pieces of a little puzzle mm-hmm. out of somebody else's mind. And so I have to be able to fly visually through any project I do on my own little drone.
Mm-hmm.
As many layers as they are.
Do you think of yourself as a painter then? Sounds like it.
I think so. I think it might be a little much for me to call myself a painter, but...
You know, you have a canvas, you have a palette of plants to choose from.
I can dip my fingers in different colors and
all over your face exactly. And your clothing. If you were going to design Central Park...
Honestly, I don't know if I would have had the Olmsted Brothers' insight. So much of what they did really was new to science, and to have the foresight to really realize that this is becoming a really populous city, and this landscape has more to do with soothing the human mind than it does about anything else,
right.
Recreation or anything else. The way they went about it, the way he went about it, and he freely admits he was making it up as he went along. He said, and I misquote, if there were just science behind what we're doing, so we're still doing this by intuition. And in a way, in a much grander sense, what I do usually in a much smaller sense, is I put myself in others' heads and think, what would make me happy here? And that's what he did with Central Park.
Yeah. I have described you as a visionary because you have this sense of seeing space or projects in space
in a way that doesn't occur to most people. How is that possible? Where does this come from? Are you just lucky? Are you blessed with this optimism?
I'm a psychopath, actually. That's fairly.
And thank you very much, everyone, for coming. It's a wrap here.
Turns out having lots of trees in a neighborhood does a lot for everything from death rates to wellness to everything else.
So here's the question I ask all my guests. Our title for this podcast is Creativity Hustlers, Fakers, and Thieves. Which one are you?
Oh, all of the above, for sure. When one works for oneself, I think you, at least in the early days, you're always hustling because what if clients stop? Sometimes creating the illusion that the atmosphere is going to be so much better in the future, either individually or in a greater sense, that's faking it. But it's not like that now.
Here's a couple of quick questions. A newcomer to the business. I don't know about the people who you have working for you, if they think about garden design or design their own gardens. How would you guide them to find the, you know, their own source of inspiration? What would you point them towards? Would it be books or would it be?
A lot of gardeners are already inspired. What often they need is just a little lesson or two about what part of the world they live in and what's going to make things most successful for them. A lot of people have come into garden design from different fields like interior design and that kind of thing. But I can't tell you the number of people who have come in to the nursery and said, oh, I just love what you do. It must be such a peaceful, easy existence. I just love to be here listening to the birds and not doing much.
I've had students say much the same to me.
Absolutely. No stress.
No stress. None whatsoever. Thanks very much for joining me today.
Pleasure.
Ali, that was my chat with Sean Hogan. What fun that was. Any thoughts? I mean, there's so much.
Where to begin? He's such a fun guy. You know, and we hung out with him that night. I really enjoyed meeting him and obviously walking on his grounds. So inspiring. But one of the things that really stuck with me was something that I've often toiled with is this notion of returning to primordial patterns and sort of following originary forms. And I think that applies across a lot of different media and art forms, you know, whether it's woodworking or in his case, landscape design, music, woodworking, writing.
I have a question for you, and I have an answer for myself, but what happens when the well runs dry? I mean, I asked that of Sean. What happens when you get stumped?
I don't have that problem.
Lucky you.
I've never had that problem. I've never understood writer's block. There's so many things I want to do that I never get to do, that I never get around to doing.
Let me just point out that, you know, things happen in a life and they knock you off track. Illness, death in the family, moving, you know, there's stuff that just gets in the way of regular creative pursuits and people can get stuck and find it hard to gain traction again. I think coming back, circling around to an idea or a project is important, letting it sit for a while.
Absolutely.
And then checking back with your gut. How do you feel when you walk into the room and you see that piece and you go, oh, that sucks. Or that is good. Now I just need to tweak this. And I think that kind of resting period helps people get, you know, re-energized about a project. Because when you're on it and you're pounding and just moving forward, you can not see the whole picture. So I think it's useful to stop and circle back and come back to it in a couple of days, a couple of weeks. Heck, I just picked up a writing project. It's been months and it's good to see it again.
I wonder if this is a challenge mostly faced by masters of a single craft. I'm a dilettante. I am not a master of anything. I am a jack of a lot of things. I'm pretty good at a whole bunch of things, and I'm not great at any of them. I have no interest in becoming great at anything because I'm too scattered. And that's what helps me never get into a hole, into a rut of wondering of like, ah, what am I going to do next? I think that what keeps it alive for me is having a great variety of different things that pique my curiosity.
Here's what I think is important to remember. It's that kind of belief in your own abilities that I think is important. It's not always fun being creative. It's hard work sometimes. But if you can produce work of your own stamp, that's really satisfying. And that gets me back to the bench, table, whatever, every time. Thanks very much for listening to us go on about this topic. Ali, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you, Gary. This has been really excellent. Again, so inspiring to listen to these people. Definitely pulls me out of the why bother more and more.
It's important to recognize that some really creative people go through that same stuff that a schmo like me does, you know, and it's just at 3 a.m, Sean's up and jotting down ideas. Pretty interesting. Anyway, thanks again.